So, since there's so many questions yesterday, I brought help today. So Dear Ajahn, what is an effective meditation object to counteract attachment and craving? For another person, an object you desire. My mind tells me don't attach, but my feelings betray me. What to do with metta? I think what the object of meditation is any object. I mean, that is the purpose of meditation, is just to bring a sense of happiness, a sense of contentment into the mind. And when you're happy and content, then you don't attach, because there's enough happiness and contentment. It is when we're not happy, we're not content, that the mind goes out and looks for things to distract itself. Or when we're suffering, then we're looking to something to counteract the discontent, wants something to replace it. So generally, any type of meditation, once you start to practice, and when the mind starts to calm down, once the mind starts to get some energy, then you'll feel that, yeah, this is kind of, oh yeah, whatever you have is good enough. What you have is fine. And you don't need anything else to make you feel better. You don't need another person to make you feel whole. This kind of narrative you get from the media is, you know, you're only a half. You need to find another half to be whole. That's rubbish. You're already whole. You just need to stand still, to slow down, to appreciate what you have already. So it's not looking outward for fulfillment, but it's looking inward and be happy what is already in the present moment. Questions or comments? Okay. Okay. Just saying that they appreciate the Q&A from last night. Thank you, Ajahn, for all your teachings. I've learned a lot. My question is, are nuns allowed to lead retreat, be in a teaching position that you're in? Or does Buddhism only allow a male to have this role? It's a good question. I think it's time for them to do some work, right? Isn't it? That's why they're sitting so far over there. So they're hiding. Now, I think, as far as I understand, the bhikkhunis, the sisters in Dhammasana, do lead retreats as well as give talks in Friday night talks. And I believe Sister Hastapanya, does she lead retreats? Yes. Yeah, she does lead retreats as well. Yeah, and there are lots of nuns who do retreats and those teachings, in different places as well. Yeah. And you stick long enough, there will be a surprise coming tomorrow. Yes?
The nuns actually give very good Dhamma talks.
Do they do it once a month or something in Dhamma Loka?
Roughly? It depends on. Okay. But I think
Grandma Asapanya can request it to go more frequently. All right, okay. Yeah, I think most of the talks are taped on YouTube anyway. So you can look it up there as well. Okay. Can you tell us a bit about BSWA? Do you conduct similar retreats in New South Wales or Victoria? Thank you. The BSWA, I think a lot of people can do a better job, but it's like the umbrella organization for kind of organizes or run Bodhinyana Monastery, which is a monk's monastery, also Dhammasara, which is a nun's monastery, also organizes and runs Jhana Grove, which is a retreat center, as well as Dhammaloka, which is the lay center that where Ajahn Brahm gives talks on Friday nights. And yeah, so that's all under, you know, kind of the umbrella of the Buddhist Society of Western Australia that organizes all these kind of monasteries and looks after the monks and nuns in there. Yeah. I think a lot more information is on their website, which is kind of Google BSWA. A lot more information is there. That's just part of Ajahn Brahm's empire. He actually, there's a lot more. You can look all that up there. Singapore, Malaysia, Melbourne, New South Wales. Can you please discuss the enlightened mind? There are many ways to approach it, but the enlightened mind, you know, what we're working kind of for, and first is something that's already, that's something that is, each and every one of us has the, you know, capacity to train for it. Enlightened mind is not male or female. It's just a state of mind, a state of deep peace, deep contentment, where there's so much happiness that you don't need to look around for anything else. There's so much energy, so much wisdom, that you completely accept the world for what it is. Yeah, so there's nothing lacking. And it's the state is, obviously, the Buddha said, you know, teaches only two things, suffering and the end of suffering. So the enlightened mind is a mind that reaches that state. But not to say that, obviously, you know, it's completely happy all the time. There is the usual suffering, the physical suffering I was talking about yesterday, of like the body, not get what you want. But the second type of suffering, which is a lot more, is the not wanting the body to be sick, not wanting to be separate from what you love, not wanting to hear unpleasant things, to feel unpleasant things. That's just part of life. You know, sometimes we get pleasant feelings and sometimes we don't. But our reaction to it makes all the difference. Yeah. So the more enlightened we are, quote unquote, the more we accept things for the way they are, without seeking to change it. Questions or comments? I could go on for a lot longer. I mean, there's different stages, but there's a lot more questions to get through. And also with anything like the teaching, it's I'm seeing my role here as not so much as the person with the answers, but really as more of a facilitator. And it's for each and every one of you to kind of reflect on it. What does it mean for yourself, the enlightened mind? So to discover your own answers in your time. Certainly giving you the tools of calming the mind down and seeing it clearly for yourself, what these truths are. Dear Ajahn, it seems to me that meditation in nature is much calmer, juicier, and generally easier. Is it just my personal preference, or is there something to it? Thanks. It's true. I mean, the Buddha, you know, did a lot of his practice in the forest, and even after he became enlightened, when his mind was super peaceful, super calm, he could have lived in the city, and he dies from time to time. But he still prefer mostly to live and carry on his teachings in the forest. So there's something to be said about just, you know, being in nature, being away from the distractions of the big city. Yeah. Being away, the, you know, kind of the high-tech gadgets. But not to say that, but there is a middle way. In Buddhism, sometimes we go over, or some other places, we go over kind of the new agey stuff, that there is kind of innate energy in the trees, or there's things that are going to help us. I think it's more just the peacefulness of nature. The sound, nature, you know, the sounds in nature of the birds doesn't really disturb your meditation. But you're sitting there and you hear a kind of siren going through, or the traffic noise for some reason. Those have a longer, kind of a lasting impact onto the mind than just kind of a natural sounds. Yeah. But having said that, a peaceful place is helpful, but it's not essential. Once you've learned to calm the mind down, you can meditate anywhere. you have the ability just to kind of not pay attention to the noise around you, or to other distracting stuff. Like I was saying, what I was kind of talking about yesterday, of sitting meditating in the sala, that there's always some kind of background noise. Someone's always knocking over something. Someone's always coughing. Someone's always slamming doors. That's just the nature of being in the sala. But after a while, you're just so absorbed into your meditation object that you don't really notice, or you don't give it much attention. It's just like something that's passing through your field of consciousness. You don't hold on to it. And that's the main thing about meditation. It's kind of the skill of focusing. What you focus on becomes reality. So you focus on the sound that lingers on, becomes louder. You focus on the stillness, the silence, that becomes more the dominant one. So that was the training and focusing. What we're aware of, what we give attention to, what we give energy to, that grows in the mind. So knowing that we're always focusing on wholesome objects, focused on peace, stillness, focus on generosity, forgiveness, compassion, and others opposite. Questions or comments? Yes?
Is there a different quality to forest versus ocean or mountain? Is there anything said about that, or is it just not really?
I think sometimes an individual thing, for myself anyway, I find the forest is most conducive. Ocean, people like the ocean, but it's the wave, it's always a sound in the background. Even it's rhythmic, there's still sound, waves crashing around. Yeah. But generally, it's still kind of, much better than kind of the sounds of the city and stuff like that. And most of the Thai tradition, in a way, all the most famous and the most enlightened monks comes from a very heavily forested area in Thailand, the northeast. Yeah. Okay, dear Ajahn, last night you said that to do lying down meditation in a different position than you sleep in. I normally sleep on my back, but I cannot lie on my side for very long without pain, so I ended up having to do lying down meditation on my back. Is it a problem? Is there some way I can program my mind to know the difference between when I'm lying down on my back to meditate versus to sleep? I find that even now I might start off lying down to meditate with my mind feeling quite bright and clear. After I lie down for a while, it's easy to drift off into sleep. So how to solve this problem? I'll just read out the questions first and I'll go back one by one. And due to back conditions, I cannot sit for too long, so I really need to learn how to do lying down meditation properly. Many thanks. Okay, so first is that you said you cannot lie on your side because it's too painful. So lying on your back is the most comfortable, but that's the position you sleep in as well. I think with anything, it's also getting used to it. Maybe when you lie on your back, you don't meditate in your bed where you sleep in. You meditate, let's say, on another place, maybe on the floor with a mat or something, or meditate in the living room. Yeah, so in a different place. Maybe in the same position, but a different place. Then the mind is set up, and then, or leave the light on or something. So the mind is set up, okay, this is not sleepy time, this is actually meditation time. Yeah. So try to meditate in a different place, even though in the same position as you are when you're sleeping. And just see whether that helps, kind of bring the awareness that you're actually there to meditate and stay awake and not to drift off to sleep. So that's one kind of a possible kind of solution. It's the same. And then the other one is, the more you meditate, the more you get a feel for it, then the mind will be able to differentiate between meditating and sleep time. Like I said, but that may take a while. I think my first couple of years of meditating as a monk, maybe still now, a lot of sleeping. Because I was really hyperactive when I was a lay person. I was running around doing things all the time. And the only time I sat still was when it's time to go to bed, when I'm sleeping, when I'm tired. So every time I lie, I would sit still. It's like, you know. But after a while, the mind just gets used to it. And I don't see that, you know, some people think it's a major problem. It isn't. It's just this ability just to bring awareness to what you're doing. So just aware the mind is sleeping. Okay, just watch the sleepiness. It stays sleepy. And then after a while, 10, 15 minutes, it starts to brighten up again. And then you can focus on your meditation object. Yeah. But anything, like I said, with different issues that come up during your practice. Not to see it as like a failing, a personal failing, a problem. They're just obstacles. They're there to provide an opportunity for you to learn and to ultimately surmount that. Yeah, so just a little test that comes along. So whether it's sleepiness, whether it's restlessness, too much thinking, see as a little challenge to investigate, to learn, and just, you know, find different ways that you can transcend it. Questions or comments? You mentioned last night the pain meditation, which is the monk exercise to explore how long it takes for the mind to split up or separate from the body. Can this separation occur from emotional distress and drama? My question is, how do you know how to reunite the mind with the body after such an event? Thank you kindly. The experience when sometimes there's a lot of pain in the body, the mind separates, but it's not kind of a little bit from drama, but it's the separation from like a samadhi. When the mind is really peaceful, it also separates out from the body. Yeah. So, but like I said, when you get there, you'll know the difference. It's not like it just drifts off somewhere. No, it's quite a pleasant experience. And when that kind of experience ends, the samadhi experience ends, it reunites naturally with the body. And then the more you do it, you can kind of get better at it, at calming the mind down and separate the pain from the body itself. And then you can see, the body can be in pain, but it's not your pain and something that you can, focus somewhere else. Like I said, there was some, Lumpur Blin who died recently. He was very gifted in his training the mind, in concentration. And he can go into these deep state, and he talked about it. He said when he was had his beak an injury on his leg that they had to operate on, and big pussy thing on his calf muscles, I think. They're trying to dig it out. And he asked the doctor not whether he didn't have to take any anesthetics to see whether he can cope with the pain and to see whether he can work with the mind. And he says, well, the doctor were a bit concerned because they said, if we cut into your leg, you're going to kick us. So we'd rather you take some anesthetics. That way you kind of either calm down or not react violently. So he really wanted to experiment to see whether, how strong his mind is, whether he can kind of deal with the pain or focus somewhere else. So they had a compromise. They will tie him up, strap his legs in, strap his hands in. He can't kick people when he's being cut, and to see whether it works. And when they did operate on him, he was perfectly still but perfectly awake. And they couldn't believe it. And they asked, well, how did you do it? Was it painful? Was he just gritting his teeth or what? He said, no. When you cut into my right leg, I put all my focus on my left leg. There's no pain there. And it was fine. Yeah. So when you, and that's something that's possible. When you learn to focus your attention, you can put it anywhere. And it's not a problem. Yeah. Yeah. He still died, obviously. Old age, sickness, and death. But not then. And that shows you that what's possible, you know, when you do, you know, kind of work with the mind, that it's whatever you focus on, that is your reality, yeah, to the exclusion of everything else. But also the other thing was that, and you hear from these people as well, that when the mind is kind of calm and focused and has a lot of energy, you can be with the pain. You're aware of the pain. That's still, but it's not as painful, if that makes sense. Just look at the pain in the knee, it's just, you know, a bit of throbbing, a bit of vibration. But it's not like, oh, this is so terrible, my pain, like something's gonna go wrong. And it's, you know, you notice and you can see that. The physical pain is one thing, it's a small portion of really the suffering. The mental reaction to the physical pain, that makes things so much unbearable. A lot of, you know, teachers would say, you know, the physical pain is only 1/10 of the whole emotional. The emotional pain is much more disturbing. And it's usually our reaction to the physical pain that makes it, you know, so terrible. But once the mind is kind of clear and bright and energetic, you can hold the sensation, unpleasant sensation in your knee or your back, whatever it may be, and you can be with it. But yeah, it's a bit of throbbing, and you see it painful, but not the end of the world. Something quite tolerable, yeah, that you can be with. The separation can, obviously, we do go into this kind of zombie state. We can separate ourselves from emotional stress, like people, you know, get attacked and assaulted. They also go into where they, you know, disconnect themselves from the body to shield it. But that's come more from emotional stress. Whereas if it's a samadhi experience, and when your mind separates from the body, it's something that happens naturally. And it's quite blissful. It's not, you know, people usually come out very, very kind of happy and rapturous. Yeah. So it's very different in that way. Questions or comments? Okay. Dear Ajahn, as lay people, most of the time of ours is spent with engaging, working with other people. What practice we take from day to day, from day to day life, towards a meditation practice? And that's fine. I mean, you know, there's time to engage and there's time to think. Sometimes people go to meditation and have this idea that, oh, we shouldn't think at all. You know, we shouldn't plan, we should stay in the present. No, I mean, these are kind of mental exercises that we do to strengthen the mind. But you're not expected to, you know, go through life with your eyes closed and sitting still and then, you know, with not talking to people. No, but these are mental exercises that are meant to strengthen the mind. And then you can go back and you can engage with people. You can still think, but you also know when to stop thinking. You know when to rest. It's the same with the body. If you exercise and run around, lift things, and not ever rest, the body breaks down very quickly. And it's the same with the mind. You need to know when to be active, to use thinking, planning, critical analysis, to look for solutions, but also when to turn that thing off. And the ability to work with the mind in more kind of a productive and effective ways. And you'll find that, yeah, when you learn how to rest the mind, allow it to rest, you'll turn off that you're actually more efficient when you do need to think, when you do need to kind of analyze things. I always find that, yeah, after, you know, kind of a good meditation, so many solutions come up for different things that might be puzzling yourself, you know, for a few days or whatever. Yeah. So a lot of times, you know, it's an experiment as well. Try not to decide on anything. Allow the decision to be made. See what happens. We like to think that we're in charge, but a lot of times, you know, different factors come together and the outcome is reached. But we like to think that we're the one doing the deciding. But, you know, sometimes you're faced with a kind of a certain issues, complicated, complex, it's hard to come up with an answer. Just wait. And then revisit it again after a good meditation and see what that feels like. generally things are much more clear, I find. So it is this training of the mind of, you know, slowing it down, but allowing the energy to come up. Allowing, you know, and clearing the mind. The mind is just too many things happening. It's really cluttered. And that's why it doesn't think, doesn't remember anything. It's not very efficient. Yeah, the same with the computer. We have lots of things, so that's why every so often you declutter it. You know, you turn everything off, and then you turn it on again. And that's the same with the meditation. You're slowing things down, making it come into a still, and then you can, you know, power up again to work. So there's nothing wrong with engaging and working with others, but there's also time for quiet time, downtime, that I think becomes more and more important. We live in a world that, like I said, can be quite noisy at times, and we bring, you know, the social medias with us to bed, waking up with it, and that's fine. It has, you know, lots of potential to connect with different people, but the downside and the irony of the whole thing is that if you're feeling tired, depleted, then actually the feeling of alienation and isolation is much more prevalent in this kind of modern digital age. So we connect with people, but not on any real level, because the mind is tired, and so. So learning how to kind of put those things in the cupboard for a few hours, a few days, you'll find that actually the connection you make when the mind is clear and energized is much deeper and lasting. Questions or comments? How do you replicate the retreat experience in everyday life? Everyday life. Thank you. Trick to that is, you don't. You have to accept when you go home that it's not retreat. You don't have this, no one's going to cook for you. You don't stand in line, unless you're a monk or not, you don't stand in line. Get food put in your bowl every day. There's kids to get to school, kids to feed and clothe and wash. There's jobs to do. So that thing is the expectations. Yeah. To realize that when you go home, there are the stress of, you know, having a home life. Also, there is the benefits of having, obviously, you know, partners and having kids and stuff. But yeah, it's not as going to be as quiet or simple. But that's okay, because you're ready, right? You have all this great, many hours and days, great experience, great meditation to rely on. The mind is bright and happy. You can handle anything. You can cope with anything. And that's the idea, was just the time here is just for you to kind of relax, recharge, re-energize, just putting down the world for a few days. And then with that, hopefully, you know, some clarity, some space. And then come back and embrace the same thing again, with a different perspective, with much energy. And the same similarly is just like a suitcase, right? You carry it around, you know, for 3-4 kilometers. It gets heavier and heavier and heavier, right? And it's almost unbearable. But the trick is that you put it down from time to time. It's not heavy at all when you put it down. Right? And the rest of it, when you pick it up, it's not as heavy. You can do that up a little bit. So the trick is, yeah, to carry a heavy load if you have to, is to take lots and lots of rest along the way. And hopefully, after a while, you realize you don't have to carry that load. Then you can leave it for a long, long time, forever. So what load are you carrying that you don't need to? That's for you to figure out. Okay? What load is it that you're carrying around all the time? Load of the body, load of personality, load of sense of self, wanting things. It's really, really heavy. But you can put it down for a while, and then pick up again. Questions or comments? Okay. Is it almost halfway through? It's time for a short break. A Dhamma talk before I have to finish my talk by 9 o'clock, I've been told. sorry. That was a request. The thing that came up today was And they come up a couple of times during the interview. People will ask, Ajahn, you've been doing this for a few years. 18 years to be exact. Can you let me know your secret? What's a shortcut to your meditation? I'm very busy. I've got kids. I've got 3 kids. I've got a job. What is the secret to getting good meditation? And the secret is lots and lots of patience. Just the ability. And also a lot of time it's just kind of the letting go. And it's something that you cannot force, something you cannot make happen. Yeah. So like, you know, kind of the Ajahn Chah teaching is, you want really good meditation, be really, really good at letting go of things. And with most things, Dhamma teaching, it's much easier for me to say it than for you to do it. But that's where the practice comes in. That's why we keep calling it the practice. It's something you do it over and over again. You mess up, keep doing it over and over again. That's why it's called the practice. Keep practicing. Keep messing up. Keep picking yourself up. Keep redoing it. Same meditation. Lose the breath. Go back to it. Keep doing it. Don't get annoyed. Don't punish yourself. Don't blame others. Just pick it up and keep doing it over and over again. And you get better at it as time goes by. Ajahn Chah said, you know, if you let go a little, you have a little happiness. You let go a lot, you have a lot of happiness. And you let go completely, you're free from suffering. Yeah. But that's the thing that, and sometimes it says for you, so it implies that it's something you do, but not really. It's actually the mind letting go, to be more exact. When mind see clearly what it is that we want or attach to, it's a lot of suffering, then it lets go naturally. Yeah. So with meditation, it's just a lot of time, it's just a lot of patience, a lot of consistency. And also a lot of managing expectation, mostly lowering it. A lot of times, you know, like I wake up and you think, you know, I have this kind of high ideals of, you know, what happiness is like. But no, generally waking up and just bowing to the shrine, being able to bow to wisdom, peace, and compassion, then that's worth it. My monk's life is worth it. Just to be bowing, to be living a simple life is worth it. Don't need to, you know, these major enlightenment experiences. Don't need the deep meditation. Don't need the deep bliss and rapture to read books. They may or may not happen. And those are extra. But really, just the fact that we're here, you're exposed to the teaching of training the mind, teaching on peace, you have the space to meditate, that is major, lots and lots of blessings. That is so much already. So with same with meditation, always kind of look for what you have already. Look for the peace already. Like I was saying yesterday, you know, just a few seconds of stillness, those are really, really precious. And focus on that. Instead of focusing on the 59 minutes and 45 seconds of just thinking and moving around, just focus on the 15 seconds of stillness. And whatever you focus on, that grows over time. Yeah, you keep training the mind. Peace just feels like this. Stillness, forgiveness, compassion, acceptance. As long as we keep reminding our mind what those positive qualities are like, what it feels like in the body, then over time the mind will naturally incline towards it. Yeah. But also in terms of meditation, how still the mind gets. On the one sense, there's kind of a incremental progressions. You know, each time you sit, you get more, you know, kind of more peaceful, more deeper. But at other times, it can drop really quickly as well. Just as quickly as we can get distracted by things and thinking, by emotions that come up, the mind can also drop things just as quickly. Once it's, you know, it gets the hang of it. Once it learns how to let go. Maybe sitting there and, you know, thinking backwards and forwards, and then say, boom, it goes really, really quiet at times. Yeah. And that's possible once, you know, the mind learns how to let go of things. So letting go is, you know, can be incremental, but also can be very, very quick as well. And that's the thing with kind of not expecting, not wanting anything, to stay in the present moment. And that's why I don't kind of go into too much details about deep meditation is like. Okay, it's something that each and every one of us can discover for ourselves. All you need to do is just sit down, sit on a chair, on a couch, and then be present. Then allow the rest of this stuff to happen by themselves. Right? Because this is a natural process of calming the mind. So that is the trick in meditation. Find a cushion and sit down. Then you're there. Any questions or comments? For the real secret, you have to shave up your head. I have the nuns asking me just after this. Dear Ajahn, can you please talk about the realities of monastic life to dissuade those of us to fantasize about it? Thank you. Don't do it. There's no escape. Now, I think with anything, one good way is just to do meditation retreats, to go to monasteries, and you'll see for yourself. It's not what you think it is. But it's not as bad as you think it is either. It's not as great, but it's not as bad either. It's lots of joy in different ways. And I think those who become monks and nuns, you hear different stories. And that a lot of time it's just it's a journey that happens by itself. The conditions come together. Yeah, I didn't set out to become a monk. It just happens that way. And with anything, you see kind of a sense of non-self, impersonal, you know, kind of force that's happening. And with anything, it's you know, we ordain, but we can also change our mind and destroy it at any time. So the only reason we're monks and nuns is that we find happiness, a sense of happiness, a sense of contentment. Doing what we're doing. But I can guarantee there are lots of challenges and, you know, in different ways, especially the first initial years. Because like I said, living in an environment where you do what you want to do, you know, myself decided what I do. I was an adult, you know, talk to whoever I want to talk, eat whatever I want to eat, whatever. And then you go to a monastery and there's lots and lots of rules that you have to follow, daily schedule that, you know, you have to kind of abide by. And you don't get to choose who you sit next to, or, you know, who you sit to your right and to your left. And yet, so, you know, we have another monk who says, you know, the people that he has to live with in the monastery, those are the people he avoids when he walks on the street. But in monastery, you can't do that. Whoever comes in next to you, you've got to sit with them. And it's like, you know, we used to have meetings like 3 times a day, and you sit with this person 3 times a day. You cannot move anywhere. This person sits to the right, this person sits to the left. And sometimes that can be really annoying people. And that happens for years and years. But that is part of the training, to make peace with, you know, and, you know, slightly unpleasant situation. I mean, even though they have differences in personality, generally nice people. But, you know, we don't always, you know, we have different personalities that sometimes clashes, different opinions, different conditioning, you know, different cultural conditioning that comes together. But part of it is just it is kind of a human laboratory, allowing you to experiment and to work through your different emotional issues and to train the mind, really. And sometimes we think that when we have choice, that it makes us, you know, the freedom to choose is something great that sometimes, you know, the world worship. Freedom to choose. More choice, the better. Now you can, you know, choose not just from, you know, buying products from Australia. You can buy products from everywhere in the world, you know, every region. All types, you know, 50 types of soy milk you can buy. 80 types of toothpaste, you know, any given market that you can look at. And we think that's great, that's progress, that's freedom. But really, it could be the opposite. But it's the tyranny of choice. That is, it's overwhelming to have so many things to think about. and that is taxing on the mind. And so sometimes when you go into an environment where you cannot choose, it forces you to deal with things, to make peace with things that you rather run away from. Yeah, so that's where kind of a lot of the training comes from. In our tradition is that through the rules, through the schedule, that we learn to make peace with the unpleasant situation and to learn to grow from that. Yeah. I find it very rewarding, but there are moments that I'd rather be somewhere else. I remember thinking as a young man, it's like, I must be be a horrible person, some horrible karma somewhere, you know, people who hurt other people and steal and kill people, they go to jail, they get to eat 3 meals a day, watch movies, watch music. That's like, I can't eat, no movies, at least celibate says, like, what's going on here? This is no fun. But after a while, you see that those things are actually, you learn to let them go. They're actually a major distraction, and that without those distractions of music and relationship, whatever, that you really can focus and train in the mind. And that's the reason why the Buddha has kind of instituted a monastic kind of culture, monasteries as well. Yeah. And it just allows people to focus a bit more. But certainly, Buddhism, meditation, it's just not for monks and nuns, it is for, everybody. And that in whatever ways you practice, those, you kind of reap the benefit from that. Questions or comments?
Yes? Can you exit after a while?
Yes, yeah, definitely. Lots of people exit. Generally, it's I think it's a rough statistics. 1 out of 4 men, anyway, I don't know how it is pronounced, 1 out of 4 men who come wanting to become monks will actually become monk. Yeah, and then for the monks who ordain, only 1 out of 4 again will make it to 5 years. Yeah. And then we're not uncommon to have monks, change their mind after 20, 30 years, whatever. And it's not a problem, because whatever, meditation you learn, you can still apply that in daily life. Yeah, sure, no problem. And you can change your mind again and come back to become a monk again, it's the same. I think for the bhikkhuni, it's not that easy. Right? Yeah. That's okay. Yeah. But I think generally in our tradition is you're not making a promise to the Buddha because he's already dead. It's just a promise to yourself and to your teacher regarding the training. And that you feel that sometimes it's too difficult for different reasons, for health reasons or whatever, or generally sometimes monks do disrobe to look after the elderly parents or something. And with different reasons to come up, people, you can change your mind. Yeah. But you have to be a minimum of 20 years old, and you do have to have the permission of your spouse also. So it's not like, oh yeah, I'm having a bad time, I'm going to become a monk or a nun. It doesn't quite work that way. Yeah, look after the kids, I'll see you in 20 years. And dear Ajahn, in your experience, what happens to the personality as the personal will or compulsion to follow desire starts to fall away? And that's interesting. It is. As you practice and as you learn to shed away, your desires and your attachments, people think, oh, do I just become a robot or something? And we're all, our enlightened beings are the same. No. And that's what I found interesting was meeting all these kind of what I find to be very well-practiced monks in Thailand. And they all seem to be quite enlightened. But they all have their own personalities. So you have a monk, Luntang Mahabua, who was kind of a boxer when he was a layperson. So he's still quite, very confrontational as a monk. But out of metta, he's just going to, he really chew you out. He thinks that's going to help you spur your practice. So it can give you a major tongue lashing. If he thinks that that's going to help you to practice. And other monks are just the opposite, are quite gentle and quite calm and to inspire you in different ways. Yeah. So it's not like you're falling away, you know, kind of you become a robot. But it's that you're letting go of the more unwholesome negative emotions, the negative mental states. And what's left is still, you know, the personality. A Western enlightened monk would be very different from a kind of a Thai enlightened monks or nuns. Yeah. And that's the interesting point, just, you know, kind of visiting different teachers. You get a sense that, you know, you don't have to be any one way. It's not kind of being somebody else, but it's kind of making peace with your own strengths and weaknesses. Yeah. Making peace, you know, with whoever you are, your own conditioning, really. Questions or comments? And that's why I find that you might also find kind of, it's nice just to read the biographies of different monks and nuns. And you see that, yeah, you know, they're not superhumans. They're just regular people with different kind of pressures and stress. And then, but through their own personal practice, their own dedication, they achieve full enlightenment. They achieve, you know, nirvana. They achieve this kind of the state of pure bliss, state of deep contentment, state of deep wisdom. And then after that, they start teaching. So it's not just for themselves that they practice, well, you know, the whole world, but the people around them that they share the knowledge with, they share the deep wisdom with.
How do you know one is enlightened?
That's the other tricky question. You don't. So to know another line to be in, you have to be one. So it does beg the question, well, you know, and everybody thinks my teacher is enlightened. Otherwise, why would I follow them, right? It's obvious. No, it is a tricky thing. Initially, it's just an intuition, you don't know. And the Buddha recommended that, you know, you hear the teaching of someone you think is enlightened, then you start to ask them questions. And you ask more teachings from them. And you come, you live with them, and you watch them. Do they act? Yeah. You know? Their actions based on greed, hatred, and delusion. Do they? You, not that you want to do that, but you know, you test them. You call them names and see what they react. Do they get angry? Different things. So you see them getting angry when they don't get their ways. And you might think, you know, monks are, you know, very lucky, or Ajahn Brahm, everybody else praises him. He always gets what he wants. He always gets the best food. Always gets compliments all day long. It's not true. When you stay close enough, he gets plenty of criticism. And that's where it's interesting. Also, you see what happens when he gets praised. You know, does it go through his head? No. It's very, very, very calm, very even, regardless. And that's when your faith increases. Yeah. But you never know for sure, because you have to be there yourself. Sure. But you can watch, and you can watch other people report from them. You know, you have monks who live with the teacher for 20 years, and he says, you know, I've never seen him lose his temper. He raises his voice, but usually out of compassion for kind of some kind of teaching purpose. Yeah. Yeah. So it is. It's kind of a faith thing until you get there yourself. Yeah. Any questions or comments? But also be careful not be fooled by very charismatic teachers. Because, you know, you've been in the spiritual scene. Lots of charismatic teachers who says, you know, very good things. But then that's when you start to look and ask questions. Do they really practice what they preach as well? Yeah. Do they walk the walk or just talk the walk? Yeah. So check out and see, you know, what they have. Do they have lots of luxurious items? Check out the monk's kuti. Is there a secret sauna somewhere they're hiding? Big screen TV? Dear Ajahn, what is the general routine at your monastery? And what is the minimum duration of one who would like to come and stay? The monastery where I'm at, we're slightly different from Bodhinyana Monastery. It's a lot more emphasis on communal practice, and especially formal. So we would meet in the meditation hall at 4 in the morning. So a bit of chanting, and sit together 4 to 6 in the morning. The lay people have to breakfast, the monks don't, we have a bit of hot drink, and then back into the sala, 7 to 9, another 2 hours. But like I said, there is in the sense you can do sitting or walking meditation. Yeah? And then after 9, we have the meal at 10 o'clock. And after that, with the usual, help clean up, finish everything by 11:30, 12. And then it's about 2 to 2.5 hours of work, cleaning toilets, sweeping, painting, a bit of maintenance, a bit of cleaning. So finish about 2:30. And you have rest time between 2:30 to about 6. And then it's tea time. So you have tea between 6 and 7. And then 7 to 9, another session of chanting and sitting meditation. Yeah, so it's about 6 hours a day, more or less. And then we used to do it on Sunday. You have extra meditation time. So instead of 7 to 9, you do 7 to 12. Yeah. So sitting and walking. So you have to sit all the time. You sit and walk. Sit and walk. And then on new moon, a full moon, we stay up all night to do sitting and walking meditation. Yeah. Generally, sometimes it gets watered down. Sometimes it's just to 12 o'clock on new moon, because there's no moon to walk around in. And then a full moon, and we do the all night kind of thing. Yeah, just sitting. But it's anything, it's just a gradual thing. You know, people sit and walk as they feel comfortable. Yeah, so that's general kind of the monastery schedule. Arjun, does the breath slow down and become shallower as the mind quiets down? It does. And that's why the, you know, kind of mindfulness, the breathing, is a good object to follow. Because as the mind becomes more calm, the breath calms down with it, actually faster. So then you have to sharpen your awareness to kind of follow the breath. Because it gets more shallow, more, you know, more subtle. And then sometimes it feels like it's disappeared, but it's not, it's just there. But the mindfulness is not kind of subtle enough to pick it up. So you have to wait a little bit. Yeah, it does become very, very calm. So sometimes you barely notice there's hardly any breathing at all. Yeah. Sometimes the breath does, you know, seems like it does disappear as well. Because the mind is so calm that you're not really breathing. Any questions or comments? Arjun, I know that I'm going to die, but don't think I've accepted that. I may die today. Do you have any advice on how I may learn to accept, I may come to accept death? Thank you. Death is something, like I said, you know, everybody has to face eventually. And that's kind of when they ask the Dalai Lama, you know, why does he practice meditation? Why do you practice all the time? You know, Dalai Lama is like practicing since he's like, you know, 2 years old or 3 years old or something. You know, very diligent meditator and practices. And why do you, you know, what's all this practice all the time? Why do you practice for? You're so holy already. Why do you practice? And he says, I practice to die gracefully. And that's the thing. It's like when, you know, the body starts to break down, it's not like the movie, you know. You don't just lean over and close your eyes. There's a bit more going on than that. And then, you know, it can be quite painful. Usually, yet, you know, you're sick from some, you know, kind of illness. And the lung is filling with water. The heart starts to stop. Feel like you can't breathe. And different things, you know, and body starts to turn itself up. It can be quite unpleasant, quite painful. And that's why we're practicing meditation. Learning to sit here, learning to put up, dealing with different pains. Learning to kind of be able to separate the pain of the body from the anxiety of the mind. And that's, and also the Buddha did recommend to contemplate death on a daily basis, as frequently as you can. Not because, you know, we're morbid or kind of weird or depressed people. As I was, you know, saying the other day, it's because our fear of death, because we don't understand death, that life can be quite confusing. Yeah. But we learn that, yeah, okay, death is just the death of the body, really. That, you know, the mind goes on. And also, we experience, you know, death is part of life. Yeah. And we die every moment. The little boy that was inside me, the teenager, is no longer here. That allows this person to be here. So there's, you know, cells changing physically. Things are changing all the time. We're shedding our skin. When we wash, hair comes out. Skin gets washed down. You know, and so that's happening constantly. It's the fact that we think there's something solid here, something permanent, that we get very shocked when we think that's been taken away from us. But actually, it's, you know, things are constantly changing. So the more we reflect on this thing, then hopefully the deeper it starts to sink into the mind. And when these things happen, then that's only when you know whether the practice is working or not. It's when sometimes you're in an accident or something. You're going down and, you know, someone's going the wrong lane. They're heading right towards you. What do you feel? There are fear, anxiety. Then you realize, oh, okay, I haven't really done enough death contemplation. You're falling down. You're falling down the roof. You start sliding down. There's a fear coming up. Or you're bitten by a snake. What comes up? But if you do a lot of death contemplation, like, yeah, of course, it's normal. You know, it's got to end sometime. And also, people think, you know, dying from accidents, from getting hurt, getting shot at, is terrible because you die early. But really, have you seen, you know, what old age looks like when you're dying of old age? You're in the hospital for months and months and years, lying in the bed that you cannot move. Cannot go to the toilet by yourself. People have to turn you over. Try lying in bed for, you know, 24 hours without moving. See how that feels like. Yeah. So actually, when the body breaks down, it's much more uncomfortable. So learning, you know, accepting that, it builds us a bit of resilience. So we know what we're in for. And then we can kind of say, can accept the old age, sickness, and death more gracefully. Dying is not the problem, it's the fighting that can be an issue at times. And so much of our world is based on denial of that. That's why we have young people on covers of magazines. You don't have people just about to die on this week's Vogue. Yeah, lady's about 98-year-old lady who's just about to die. She's a new Vogue cover of the Vogue magazine. Usually it doesn't work that way. It doesn't sell magazines that way. No, someone's in their 20s, lots of makeup, lots of Photoshop. Yeah, this is ideal. We're always going to be that. That's the perfection. But actually, life isn't like that. So that's why we need to kind of sometimes, you know, go against it. But reflecting on kind of the nature of reality. And the more we try to dismiss it, it's the more it brings up, you know, anxieties and worries and suffering later on when we do have to face it and we're not prepared. That's the main thing. Yeah. So that's why there's those kind of daily reflections on OA, sickness, and death. That it's not really morbid, it's just the opposite. When you make peace with it, there's a lot of happiness, a lot of release comes from being able to accept things for the way they are. And you can see that, you know, you can test them. Every time you get sick, what is the mental state like? When you're feeling weak, are you okay with that? Or you get really annoyed that you don't get to do things, you know, being so, you know, being sick gets in the way of your activities, in the way of doing work. But that's just a natural part of the body. You used to be sick from time to time. Yeah, so the practice is, you know, making peace, to learning, to age gracefully. In the U.S., telling the same story over and over again, but in the U.S., yeah, I told you that, you know, the beauty industry is a multi-billion-dollar industry. And that promotes just the opposite, youth eternal, and beauty, which will last forever, right? And it creates a lot of false expectations. If you don't look like this, then something's wrong with you. How many people look like the covers of, you know, magazines? Really? Very few. But yet, that's where the standards we're supposed to hold on to. That's ridiculous. Sometimes you see the magazine, the lady, you know, of course it's a cream, kind of an aging cream. And she says, I know I'm going to get old, but I'm going to fight every step of the way. And that's the fight you're not going to win. It's not going to win. How much cream you put on, how expensive it is. It's not going to happen. You're going to age, I guarantee. And that's the thing. But that's hopefully the practice of the Dhamma is, you know, it's okay to age. It's whether you age gracefully or not. Whether you die gracefully, that makes a difference. Not whether you die or live. It's how you do it. So with peace, equanimity, with acceptance, or is it with a lot of anxieties and worries? Yeah. And that's the difference. So that's why, that's the practice. We keep practicing. We lose it, we keep practicing. Get on the horse, keep walking. Get on the breath, keep watching it. The mind veers up, that's okay. Go back to the breath. No need to worry. Questions or comments? Yeah, should practice really, really hard. You might die tonight. Yes?
Talking about the suicide of his lecturer. I mean, he lived up to 104,
uh-huh.
Decided that it's enough.
Uh-huh.
And he claims that he's at peace with dying, you know, going to Switzerland and killing himself.
Uh-huh. I think people have different ways to obviously, you know, want to end their life. And from Buddhist perspective, there's no official line of, you know, it's wrong to take your life, to commit suicide. From a Buddhist perspective, suicide is not very helpful. Because usually people commit suicide generally from, you know, depression, negativity. You want, you know, you can't deal with life, so you want to end it. But a lot of time, Ajahn Chah said, is that committing suicide is like you have an itch on your head and you scratch your bum. It doesn't really solve the problem. Because mainly the pain is in the head, right in your heart. And you kill the body, guess what's left? The mind is still there. Yeah, from a Buddhist perspective, consciousness doesn't end with the body. You're still there. So imagine how, you know, you're like, oh, things are going wrong, you know, I can't pay my mortgage, my wife ran away from me, lost my job, might as well end everything. And then I'm really depressed, I'm going to kill myself. And imagine how depressed you'll be when you find out that you're cutting your wrist, didn't solve the problem. You're still there. All the pain is still there because now you've got a mind with no body. That's terrible. And that's why, as a Buddhist, you're not recommended in that way, because the suffering that you have in the mind is independent of the body. And when you kill the body, what's left is, yeah, all the pain and misery, and that, and it's hard to get out of it. If you have a body, you know, no matter how depressed you are, generally time passes, you've got to go and do different things and to change the focus. But there's no body to ground yourself. You know, the mind can get stuck in those kind of negative states for a long, 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 long time. Yeah. So as a Buddhist perspective, that's why it's not recommended. Usually when you want to end your life, it's through some negative emotion. But, however, you can end your life from kind of a place of peace and stillness, of acceptance. Okay, I've lived 104 years. It's enough. I'm going to, whatever, do something to end it quickly. Yeah, it's not an issue. It's not a problem. You can end it without any negativity. Yeah, that's a problem. Yeah, that's the trick sometimes. Generally, people do take their life from negativity, not from a place of peace. But there are, you know, there's a growing awareness that people who have kind of life-threatening disease, that they're in pain the whole time, and then they decided to take their life because it's, you know, it's just too painful to go on. And they come from a place of peace. Okay, you know, I have this disease that they cannot cure, and I'm a burden to my family, whatever. What am I, you know, take that out. As long as you make it and you really, really reflect on it, really know for sure that it's not from negativity, trying to hide or trying to, you know, disappear, annihilate yourself, then yeah, then it doesn't create kind of negative karma as a result. Questions, comments? No. Yeah.
Can we help those people? people that have committed suicide out of negativity. Is there any way we can help them from here?
Generally, with the people who passed away, you know, Buddhist cosmology, there's just mental energy, and they still generally linger around a little bit, generally around people they love or places they are used to. Yeah. And we can do it. It depends on two. One is your connection with the person who passed away and how strong your mind is. The closer connection, the more they can feel. But generally, if you have a very clear, bright, powerful mind, then people can feel that as well. So what we do is, we, as Buddhist kind of monks, we try to send them good energy when we do chanting for different people who passed away through suicide. But sometimes, like I said, people who in that state, they're so negative, that usually they're kind of, it's hard for them to pick up other beings around them because they're so consumed with their own suffering. Yeah. So it has to be very, very kind of a very strong, powerful mind that sends them this kind of wholesome energy that helps them kind of move on. Questions or comments? Dear Ajahn, can you please explain the benefits of body contemplation and meditation that you went through this morning? Thank you. That fits into what we're saying now. The benefit of contemplating the body and the different ways of doing that. You can contemplate, you know, the different parts of the body to see that it's just, you know, like the five parts of the body that as novices or young monks were kind of encouraged to contemplate are hair of the head, hair of the body, teeth, skin, and nails. And what when you think about it, that is what you see in another person. When you look at another person, you see, yeah, Joe, or George, or whatever. But it's just you're seeing a bunch of hair, and the body, hair of the head, but the skin, the teeth, and nails. And guess what? Those are all dead stuff. That's you're shedding that constantly. They're shedding, moving on. Yeah. So you reflect, like, what is head of hair made of? You know, people spend billions and billions of dollars of in products and in salons and bits and pieces, but it's just dressing up. What's going to fall out naturally anyway? But yet we spend so much. And then it's made up of, you know, it's the only thing that's alive is the roots of the hair. And that's made up, you know, kind of fats and proteins that you eat and that leaks out of the head. The same as the skin. Yeah, it's just kind of layers and layers of, you know, the outer layer is kind of dead and you're shedding it away. So by reflecting on these kind of body parts, you see for what they are, just not beautiful, you know, not great. Generally, on the opposite, generally kind of unattractive. You see someone's hair in your soup, and you're not gonna, they're not very attractive. But yet, we spend lots of money on hair, but see hair on the soup, it's not like, tasty. No, it's just the opposite. Yeah, and nails and all that, it's the same. But that's just the reflection. So body contemplation is meant to bring up this sense of more dispassion against lust. Because when we, you know, think about it, we think, you know, we look at the body, we're always looking for the beautiful bits. We're always looking at young, attractive people. So as a contemplation, ask people as well, as practitioner, instead of focusing on the attractive, young, beautiful models that you see in magazine, you focus on the opposite, on the older people, the graying one, the old age one. Or you visualize them 80 years from now, what would that look like? So it brings more of a balanced way, because that's what lust is about. When you're feeling lust, you're looking at the beauty of things and not at the other aspect of the picture as well. So as young monks, obviously we have to be celibate. There's a lot of training to look at the unattractiveness about, you know, a feature of another person, another body. Especially if you're prone to sexual attraction, to look at the unattractiveness of the lady that you come into contact with. Or the men, in this case maybe. To just counterbalance focusing on always the beautiful and attractive part. After a while, you can see both. There's beauty, but it's also an unpleasant aspect of it. And the mind become more balanced. And the other one, it was just imagining, saying, you go visit people in hospitals, relative, a friend, instead of saying, oh, you poor sick thing over there, they're the sick one. You try to put yourself in that bed. But, one day you'll be there as well. Yeah. Oh, age, people in the 80, 90 years old lying in bed, that's also me there one day. Sometimes we like to disassociate ourselves from these things. It's just somebody over there is getting sick and dying. It's not me in here. And when we keep training ourselves, keep saying, okay, yeah, it's me there. Visualizing yourself lying there, really. Visualizing what it would be like on your on your funeral. Who's going to show up? What's it like? Which suit would you wear when you're lying there? How does it feel? Yeah, so we do all kind of mental exercises just to really kind of drill it in. Because the mind doesn't like to think about those kind of things. It wants to live forever. And then when the time does come to deal with reality, it gets there's a lot of fear and anxiety, a lot of suffering involved based on that. But we learn to kind of go through these kind of exercises. Then there's a sense of more peace, sense of stillness, sense of courage. To face them, to accept when it's time for us to go. So that is kind of the encouragement to practice. Contemplating different things. And it's true, people think, contemplating, don't you get depressed and this? And that's the thing you have to know for yourself. The mind does get too depressed, you contemplate sickness and death. Then you do turn it more to loving kindness, something that brings a bit more joy. And then you come back to the object again. Which, by the way, metta meditation is tomorrow's topic. So we'll get there. But sometimes the opposite. Reflecting on the body brings a lot of happiness, actually. Bring a lot of joy. Because with come acceptance, freedom. It's through hiding, trying to push things away, there's a lot of anxieties and worries. But we accept, embrace things. There's nothing to lose. Why afraid of death or the death of the body when there's nothing here anyway? It's just a bunch of elements. And it reminds us, this body that we have, which is just on loan for us, it's not going to last a long time. So it always encourages what we're going to do with the time that we have on earth. What things we're focused on. That's beneficial to ourselves and others. Is it? It's something that we all have to learn for ourselves. Is it just to be a success? Have lots of houses, boats, be well-liked, be powerful? Can you take that with you? Or is it something else? Each and every one of us to kind of find those answers for ourselves. Why are we here? Why are we here? Keep asking yourself that and see what comes up. Questions, comments? Last question. Oh, okay. Dear Ajahn, after I wake up in the morning, I spend some time, say 30 minutes, laying in bed, trying to mindfully be with any emotional reverberations, e.g. anxiety, sadness, etc., that might have been stirred up from my dreams or noticing what thoughts come up first thing in the morning. Maybe some resolution with some issues I was dealing with the previous day. I feel that if I just jump right out of bed as soon as I wake up, I might not process these things or end up suppressing them. Do you think this is a legitimate or useful meditation practice? Or is it my laziness, my defilements, making excuses to stay in bed longer? Is it very cold as well in the morning when you decided to reflect on life? Admittedly, I sometimes doze off again. Well, practicing, quote unquote, being aware of thoughts and emotion. Thank you for any advice. I think it's early morning might not be the best time to reflect on life. And you can also reflect while you're sitting upright in meditation too. But with anything, you know, to know for yourself, to experiment, you know, on the weekend we have time, lie in bed for an extra half an hour, to work through these kind of emotional issues that happen early in the week, early in the day. Or vice versa, jump out of bed, you know, do a bit of exercise, some drink, hot tea or coffee or something, and then sit down again, and then try to process that and see, you know, kind of what the difference is. Yeah. Because sometimes, you know, the waking up brings a bit more clarity. Sometimes we're kind of processing it, but actually, yeah, it's just kind of bits and pieces, you know, floating through, and that we're not so aware of the thought because we're like, yeah, half asleep or you know, moving back to the sleepy state. But it's also very useful. Like I said, you know, some people mention that now they've come to this quiet center, the mind starts to, first few days, got to go on overdrive, and a lot of things that they haven't thought about starts to come up. Different thoughts about events in the past, different emotional states that come up as well. And they're wondering why. And I think it's normal, because in a day-to-day life, we're so busy that we generally don't process them or give them, you know, kind of due kind of diligence, due kind of notice to process them properly. And so they get suppressed, they get pushed down, and they don't go away by themselves. Yeah, so it is good to, from time to time, give them the space, the care and attention, different things that come up, the disappointment, the disagreements, the hurt feelings that we haven't acknowledged, feeling of loss or anxieties that comes up from time to time through our interactions with the world around us. Those things stay there. And that's what the practice of meditation is called, the purification process. Purifying the mind. But this does. It doesn't purify by itself. Living life brings a sense of, you know, a certain amount of stress and tension and loss. And it is through meditation that we learn to kind of be at ease with these, to resolve these, to allow them to kind of come up and allow them to fade away properly. But we dismiss them too quickly. We didn't process them. Just cover up by distracting ourselves through entertaining or through drugs and alcohol. They stay there. And over time, they start to fester, become more toxic. That's why you have the people, as they get older, they do psychological things. As people get older, they get more negative. Because we don't learn to let go of, you know, the disappointments of life, the negativity of life. They build up over time. So letting go is something that you have to be conscious of, be aware of, to process them as they arise. And that's why sometimes, you know, your half an hour meditation, you're sitting there and just, you know, kind of just processing the day's events. And you might think it's a waste of time, but it isn't. It's just, unless you're processing them, they're there. And they might come back to haunt us later on. We haven't processed them properly. So meditation doesn't always have to be a peaceful, a quiet event. It could be just, yeah, processing emotional dramas, the stress of life, a work, relationship that comes up, you know, in the world. But that's also fine. That's what it's there for. Ability just to reflect, to distill, and to learn from life. That comes from having a still mind, a clear mind. Okay, so that is the last question. Additional questions or comments? Yes?
How do you know the difference from what you've just talked about, something that requires reflection or something that's just a repetitive thought loop that you can step away from?
After a while, you'll see that we all have a kind of a broken record mind, I say. It's the same dialogue comes up over. After a while, yeah, here we go again, you know, blah, 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 your favorite song or your favorite scenarios, your favorite holidays, or your favorite person, favorite relationship, or the opposite. Someone's called you something you didn't like, and you keep repeating these things. So after a while, it's like, okay, here we go again. So you see that they're quite repetitive, loopy thing. But other times, other things come up. And if it's just kind of a certain leftover from events of the past or something in the future, about anxiety about the future events, they come and go. But then certain things, deep, you know, kind of a more deeply traumatic things come up of a deep nature. Like it does, it has kind of an emotional flavor to it. Then you say, okay, oh, I wonder that's coming from. Sometimes you feel like a lot of... well, I find personally like a feeling like deep sadness comes all of a sudden. I'm like, where is that coming from? And then that's when you just sit with it. I'm like, oh, okay. This is different than kind of the day-to-day chatter, inner chatter or background chatter that you get from time to time, that we all get. And as you meditate, you get better at kind of differentiating between, you know, the background chatter, the white noise that we all kind of get you know, from time to time, than something else. That you need to work through. And it's, yeah, like it could be just starting from a tense area, or it could be just a kind of a feeling of really strong fear or anxiety. Like, what is this all about? And then, yeah, just sitting with it, allowing that to be, because sometimes, you know, we push that away because this is unpleasant, but then it comes back as, you know, full-on panic attack later on or something. But just the ability just to sit. Yeah, and that kind of the courage, the spaciousness, just to allow these things to come up, really. That will help them, you know, kind of resolve themselves. And sometimes it's not like anything you actively do, but just being with these things, being with these emotional states that come up, the sadness, feeling of loneliness, or feeling of like a big pit the first few years of my muscle, like this pit in my stomach that opens up, like, oh, that doesn't feel very good. But just sitting with it, exploring it, not kind of casting blame or feeling guilty over it, but just like, oh, I wonder what this is all about. And sometimes it's just, yeah, you know, we fill our life, I just said the pit of sensuality, we fill our life with things, and then we can't do that anymore. It feels like it's so empty that we need to constantly, you know, fill it with movies and holidays and relationships and achievements and work and this, and it goes on. And when you can't do that anymore, it feels like, yeah, your whole body seems to open up. This vast emptiness that comes. And that's not uncommon to get these feelings from time to time. But the main thing is, yeah, just to kind of sit with it and then trust in your ability to see. Like Lumpo Lim said, you know, wherever there's ignorance, there's wisdom right there. Wherever there's suffering, there's also happiness. I mean, it's our job is just to distill, to allow really the happiness to arise from that. Just through staying with it, accepting it, making peace with it. Does that make sense? Or?
It does. I want to ask something further.
Yeah.
Things like that have happened for me, and I've been able to sit with them very deeply and am constantly surprised years later when it comes up again. Because I think, no, I've sat with that, I've embraced it, I've fully, you know, been with it,
yeah.
And yet it's still there. Is that just something that you find continues, that it's never fully, I guess if we're speaking of an emotional trauma or something like that, it can have more and more subtle ways of,
expressing yourself, yeah, it's normal. Yeah, we do. We're like, oh, yeah, I finished with it. But it's just our own, you know, kind of a deluded mind that thinks, oh, yeah, I'm done with it. I want to do something else now. But it will come back over and over again. And finally, if you fully embrace it, and then you only know that if it doesn't come back. You fully embrace it, it will go away. Because then it doesn't matter anymore. Or you fully embrace it as a friend. Oh, yeah, here we go again. Oh, yeah, that feeling. I remember you. Yeah, okay. Loneliness, that's not so bad. Fear, oh, yeah, fear. Come in, my friend. I remember you. You're with me for a while now. And that's okay. You can stay as long as you want. It doesn't matter. I'm not trying to push you away, really. You're part of life. You belong just as much as happiness, as much as joy. Fear, anxiety, failure, sadness, they all belong. And once we get to that space, then it's not an issue. But it takes time, and that's the trick with these emotional issues and even practice. It's never quite as quick as you want it to be. You don't get this deep jhanas so quickly. But they're there, and you eventually get there. It's just, it takes time. Yeah? And a whole lot of patience. It's kind of in between. Like, it goes away when you fully understand it. So some people find it, for them, they just kind of be with it and just allow it to be, and it works itself well. Other people, they find that a bit of investigation also helps to alleviate it. So there's a point of kind of, when we investigate it, do we hold on to the drama and the stories around it, or are we just going to investigate it to better understand where it's coming from, and then just to make peace and to allow, accept the situation. And yeah, that happened, it was unfortunate, that's okay. I accept it, I forgive, I'm gonna move on now. Yeah, so it depends on, how the, whether investigation helps, to move things along, or is it adding more to the layers of the narrative that keeps it around more? And it's something that you have to experiment. Like sometimes when you kind of just embrace it without naming or that, analyzing it too much, and this feeling does kind of resolve itself and move away, or some kind of verbal analytical thought of, okay, why is this coming from? How do I feel? And then dig into the story that kind of started, the narrative that started around these emotions. Sometimes that helps them to resolve themselves as well. Okay, great. Thank you for all your questions. So I'll continue sitting. I'll have a night. And today is also a new moon. New moon night. Mm. So you can invite it to stay up to 12 o'clock if you want.